Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello from Washington. We are back to help you learn and improve your American English skills. Each day we present interesting stories from around the world in a way that makes it easy for you to follow along if English is not your first language. Today we have two stories for you. The first one is about a new way to make tea that is easier on the environment. Then we're off to the UK for a story about the real estate market and dirty Russian money. It's a chance for you to listen and learn with the Voice of America. Here is part one. There is a change in the air at the tea factory in Tika, Kenya. It is free of the dark smoke that rises from the boilers of Kenya's other tea factories. The Makumboki Company has begun to use a less costly and more environmentally friendly fuel. Instead of burning wood, the tea maker is burning briquettes made of plant and animal material waste. Jonathan Evans has the story.
The Kenya Tea Development Authority supervises 66 tea factories in the country. Makumboki is the only one that does not use firewood in tea production. Its factory is deep in central Kenya's hilly and fertile tea-growing Murang'a County. The Makumboki employees there feed the factory's boilers with briquettes of macadamia, cashew, and rice husks, the dry outer covering of the seeds mixed with sawdust. John Jatao is the manager at the factory. He expressed excitement about the change in fuel at the factory. He said Makumboki has not used a single cubic meter of firewood in the last 6 months. In 2010, the International Trade Center started a training project. It aimed to teach Kenyan tea makers new production methods that would help limit the release of climate change gases. As a result, Makumboki company leaders decided to change their fuel source from firewood to briquettes. Since then, the factory has increased its use of alternative fuels and stopped depending on firewood. Taylors of Harrogate is a Makumboki client. The British Tea and Coffee Company helped the Kenyan factory change fuels. It connected Makumboki with the Living Earth Foundation. The non-governmental group donated the machines to make the briquettes. The husks for the briquettes come from other factories within Murang'a and Kiambu counties. The sawdust comes from mills near the tea factory. John Jatao said, "It takes the factory 6 months to produce about 2.5 million kilograms of tea. During that time, their boilers would use up to 10,000 cubic meters of wood, or about 30,000 trees worth." He said by trading firewood for sawdust and briquettes, Makumboki alone will have saved 60,000 trees in 1 year. And he said, "If all the factories in Kenya did this, a lot of trees would be saved." Mary Njinga is a postdoctoral fellow of bioenergy at the World Agroforestry Center. She welcomes the use of sawdust in the making of fuel briquettes. She said, "Burning sawdust is efficient. The temperatures inside the boilers of tea factories are so high," she said, "they are able to more fully burn the particulate matter and the carbon dioxide so that little is released." Makumboki manager John Jatao said, "Tea factories that continue to use firewood can't ignore their own part in the adverse effects of climate change. The move away from firewood also makes financial sense. Mr. Jatau said changing to fuel briquettes has reduced Makamboki's energy cost by nearly half. The factory used to spend $542,000 per year on firewood. Now, the introduction of briquettes has cut the energy bill to $295,600. John Jatau said, representatives from other factories have visited Makamboki to learn more about the alternative fuel. He said he hopes they will follow his company's lead. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Anti-corruption activists say billions of dollars earned from criminal acts are passing through the London property market. They also say a lot of the money for housing and other real estate is coming from Russia. The British government is now promising to fight the money laundering activities. But one investment advisor told VOA the government has known about the problem for years. Bob Doty has our report.
Over the past 5 years, major properties in London have risen in value by 42%. Activists say one reason for the increase is the rise in the use of what they call dirty money to buy homes and buildings. Recently, a British television program reported on an investigation into the use of stolen money to buy property. The program was called From Russia with Cash. In the show, anti-corruption activist Roman Borisovich was seen speaking with several real estate agents in central London. Mr. Borisovich told them he was a Russian government minister who wanted to buy property with stolen money. The activist later told VOA on Skype that the agents did not care where the money came from.
They were all eager to proceed. Even if when I was telling them that the money was meant for procurement of drugs and I stole the money, and you know, obviously some sick people were deprived of health care, and they could not care less.
Mr. Borisovich says the real estate agents all suggested he buy the properties through overseas companies to hide the identity of the buyer. He says one agent proposed he use the relaxed tax laws of Cyprus and the British dependency of Jersey to create a trust. The agent said this legal agreement then could be used to set up what investigators call a shell company.
And this particular agent was volunteering to put us in front of a Jersey financiers to put the trust together and a secret lawyer to put everything else together.
The British government says foreign companies own $191 billion worth of property in Britain. Prime Minister David Cameron has said that most are legal businesses, but he admitted some are not.
We need to stop corrupt officials or organized criminals using anonymous shell companies to invest their ill-gotten gains in London property without being tracked down.
Justin Urquhart Stewart works at Seven Investment Management. The company helps people invest money. He says the British government has known about the money laundering problems for years.
And this is dirty money, coming from crime, maybe coming from terrorism. So this needs to be dealt with now.
British law says real estate agents must tell officials if they believe the money being used to buy property comes from criminal activities. But many agents say they should not be expected to know the source of money, especially when buyers are using complex methods to hide fraud. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to VOA. The Voice of America.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Plant roots are important to life on Earth. Roots take in water and nutrients that the plant needs to live and grow. They also help secure plants in dirt to prevent erosion, the breakdown of soil by natural forces. Roots are the subject of a new exhibit at the United States Botanic Garden in Washington, D.C. It shows in great detail what is taking place underground and the ecosystem services roots provide. The exhibit is called Exposed: The Secret Life of Roots. Megan Freer went to the show recently.
I was like, oh, an exhibit on roots. How boring can this be? But then you walk in and you're just, wow.
Visitors to the Botanic Garden see dry roots hanging on a display wall in a large room. Some of the roots are from native prairie grasses. Others are from crop plants like wheat and corn. All of the roots are rolled up and dried up so they do not touch the floor. A few of the roots are several meters long. Susan Pell is Science and Public Programs Manager at the U.S. Botanic Garden. She says this unexpected sight sends a powerful message to the visitors. Roots are the foundation for life.
They are what absorb nutrients for the plants, absorb water for the plants, to allow the plants to photosynthesize and to make sugars. And plants themselves are really what we depend on entirely as a species.
The roots appear to be growing out of a wide view picture of a farmer's field. Visitors can also see some of the grasses outside the Botanic Garden. They are growing with garden vegetables like carrots and beets. Susan Pell takes hold of a soybean plant and explains why farmers depend on roots.
They have these little nodules on them which contain a bacterium which fixes nitrogen. And that's sort of a fancy way of saying it makes nutrients available to plants that otherwise would not be available to those plants.
And that is important because it helps plants grow. Louisa Balin lives in the southeastern state of Florida. Florida's ecosystem is very different from the grasslands of the American Midwest. In the exhibit, she gets a sense of the problem in drought-stricken areas where roots run deep.
If these have to go so deep into the ground and they need water for sustenance, you just really kind of wonder, are we going to be able to sustain agriculture?
Program manager Susan Pell hopes visitors like Ms. Balin leave with a new understanding of our natural systems and the urgency to protect them from environmental problems. And that's the VOA Environment and Science Report. I'm Marcia James.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. We've been discussing the presidency of Thomas Jefferson. He was America's third president, elected in 1800.
In our last program, we talked about the dispute between Jefferson and the Chief Justice of the United States. Jefferson believed the Constitution gave Congress the right to decide the country's laws. But Chief Justice John Marshall believed the Supreme Court had the final say. The two men's beliefs were tested in a case called Marbury versus Madison. John Marshall's arguments won. He wrote a decision saying the Supreme Court had the power to rule on the laws that Congress passed. The Supreme Court did not act on that power during Jefferson's administration. But John Marshall's decision did help establish the role of the Supreme Court in the American government. The Marbury versus Madison case is one of the important legacies of Jefferson's presidency. But historian Joseph Ellis says it was not the only one.
The major achievement of Jefferson's presidency is the Louisiana Purchase, which is a lot of luck, as well as his willingness to take advantage of the luck.
The story of the Louisiana Purchase begins with France and Spain. The two European countries wanted to limit the power of the United States. So in 1800, Spain and France entered into a secret treaty. In the treaty, Spain gave France control of a large area in North America called the Louisiana Territory. The Louisiana Territory stretched north to south from the Gulf of Mexico to Canada, and it stretched east to west from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains. The area was important not only for its large size, it also included some valuable navigation features, including where the Mississippi River opened into the Gulf of Mexico. Napoleon Bonaparte ruled France at that time. Jefferson did not want Napoleon in North America. He felt the French presence was a threat to the peace of the United States. He decided to try to buy parts of the Louisiana Territory, especially around the mouth of the Mississippi River near the city of New Orleans. Jefferson sent James Monroe to Paris as a special negotiator, but Monroe never had a chance to offer the American position. Napoleon had decided to sell everything to the Americans. He told his finance minister to give up Louisiana, all of it. Napoleon needed money for a war with Britain. James Monroe was happy to negotiate the purchase of Louisiana. They agreed on a price of 80 million francs for all the land drained by the Great Mississippi River and all its many streams. The Louisiana Purchase nearly doubled the size of the United States at that time. It included the present-day states of Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska. It stretched into parts of Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, and Louisiana. The Louisiana Purchase also opened the Mississippi River to American commerce and travel. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says that as a result of this access, the Louisiana Purchase fueled the country's economic expansion in the 19th century. And Mr. O'Shaughnessy says the Louisiana Purchase created more opportunities for Americans to own land.
It was very important to Jefferson because he really wanted every free member of society to be able to own land. He regarded land ownership as, in many ways, essential to someone's independence and their ability, therefore, to participate in a republican government.
But both Mr. O'Shaughnessy and historian Joseph Ellis say the Louisiana Purchase went against Jefferson's beliefs about central government. Joseph Ellis says that in many ways, Jefferson's presidency aimed to make the federal government almost invisible and to limit the president's power.
And the Louisiana Purchase is the most authoritative executive action in American presidential history. One president decides to buy the Midwest, and he does it unilaterally.
Historians say the Louisiana Purchase is one example of Jefferson's contradictory character, in which he says one thing but does another. Andrew O'Shaughnessy adds that Jefferson made trade-offs. When he bought Louisiana, Jefferson used presidential power in a way that was not specifically permitted by the Constitution. But Mr. O'Shaughnessy says Jefferson was also looking to the higher good. In the case of the Louisiana Purchase, the good of improving the country's political health. Federalists in the early 1800s also questioned Jefferson's decision to buy Louisiana. They feared it would weaken the power of the states of the Northeast. Federalist leaders made a plan to form a new government of those states. But to succeed, they needed the state of New York. Their plan for a new government led to another memorable episode in American history. Aaron Burr was vice president during Thomas Jefferson's first term. Burr became a candidate for New York governor. The Federalists believed Burr would win the election, become governor, and support their plan. But Federalist leader Alexander Hamilton did not trust Burr. The two had been enemies for a long time. Hamilton made some strong statements against Burr during the election campaign in New York. The comments later appeared in several newspapers. Burr lost the New York election. The Federalist plan for a new government of northeastern states died. New York historian Valerie Paley says Burr heard about Hamilton's strong comments. He was offended.
He called him something like despicable. It hinged on a word, one word, and a word as simple as despicable.
Burr asked Hamilton to admit or deny the comments. Hamilton refused. The two men exchanged more notes. Burr was not satisfied with Hamilton's answers. He believed Hamilton had attacked his honor. Burr demanded a duel. A duel is a fight, usually with guns. Valerie Paley says, in those days, gentlemen often used duels to settle rivalries and defend their honor.
So it wasn't so much these men dueled to kill, they would purposely miss their shots, and then the air would be cleared.
Hamilton opposed duels, yet he agreed to fight Burr on July 11, 1804. The two men met at Weehawken, New Jersey, just across the Hudson River from New York City. The duel would take place by the water's edge at the bottom of a high rock wall. The guns were loaded. Burr and Hamilton took their places. One of Hamilton's friends explained the rules. "Are you ready, gentlemen?" he asked. Both answered yes. There was a moment of silence. He gave the signal. Burr and Hamilton raised their guns. Two shots split the air. Hamilton raised up on his toes,
then fell to the ground. Burr remained standing. He looked at Hamilton with regret, then left. Hamilton died the next day. He was not yet 50. Valerie Paley says Hamilton's story is almost like a television or newspaper drama.
He was extremely attractive, and he had such a romantic story. Here he is, the immigrant boy from the West Indies, made good, comes to New York, goes to King's College, becomes a sort of a self-taught lawyer, becomes aide-de-camp to Washington, all sorts of extraordinary things, marries so well, and also has this vision of what modern America might become, and in many ways was able to implement at least an early bit of that vision before his death.
Hamilton had made a big impact on the United States. He had created a national bank and influenced many government policies. Newspapers throughout the nation reported his death. Most people accepted the news calmly. To them, it was simply the sad end to an old private dispute. In the months after Hamilton's death, the nation prepared for the next presidential election. Once again, the Republican Party chose Thomas Jefferson as its candidate for president. But the Republicans refused to support Aaron Burr for vice president again. Instead, they chose George Clinton. Clinton had served as governor of New York 7 times. The Federalist Party chose Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina as its candidate for president. It chose Rufus King of New York to be its vice presidential candidate. The campaign was quiet. In those days, candidates did not make many speeches. Republican pamphlets told of the progress made during the past 4 years. The former Federalist administration raised taxes, they said. Jefferson ended many of the taxes. The Federalists borrowed millions of dollars. Jefferson borrowed none. And Jefferson got the Louisiana Territory without going to war. The Federalists could not dispute these facts. They expected that Jefferson would be reelected, but they were sure their candidate would get as many as 40 electoral votes. The results shocked the Federalists. Jefferson received 162 electoral votes. Pinckney received just 14. One man tried to explain the meaning of Jefferson's great victory. He was John Quincy Adams, son of former President John Adams. President Adams had been a firm Federalist. This is what his son said. "The power of Jefferson's administration rests on a strong majority of the American people. The president has great popular support. His re-election shows that the experiment of the Federalists has failed. It never can and never will be brought to life again. To try to bring it back would be foolish. It would be like trying to put life into a body that has been buried for years." After the election of 1804, only 7 Federalists remained in the United States Senate. Only 25 remained in the House of Representatives. Thomas Jefferson would be president for another 4 years. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us each week for The Making of a Nation.